Today's podcast is about capitalism, socialism, and communism, broadly. The big ideas, I guess, so to speak. And it is easy to get caught in rhetoric about what these terms mean, with differing views. So hopefully today's podcast will help clarify some of our thinking and the meaning behind these words and their historical usage to then better reflect their usage today. We are also aiming with the enlightening of the words, the definitions of these words. We are aiming at showing a discrepancy between the idea of the market and those who participate in the market, and what that political relation has on the impact one can have in the market, the determination they may have politically, and ultimately freedom that they may have. So, Richard, can you set us where you see the tensions residing between these words like capitalism, socialism, and communism, and their use in political discourse?
You know, we see in this political season, the Republican Party, particularly at its convention, branding Joe Biden and Kamala Harris as socialists, in fact, trying to brand the entire Democratic Party as being something that had become a kind of socialist, anti-capitalist party. And on the other hand, you had certain people in the Democratic Party, not Biden, certainly, but figures like AOC, Bernie Sanders, and others willingly take on the mantle of socialism, of at least democratic socialism. And I think these various kind of oppositions where the term is bandied around and presented pro and con is quite misleading. And I think it's useful to think about what the term socialism has come to mean historically. Because to begin with, there was a socialist movement that arose particularly in the 19th century. People like Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels were among those who took a leading role in it. And some of them certainly regarded capitalism as an economic formation that was something bereft of any abiding normative validity. They regarded it as something that was inherently unjust, that it could not help but lead to economic inequities that were a threat to freedom, and spoke of overcoming capitalism and replacing it entirely with a different system, which at times was spoken of as socialism, at other times as being a matter of communism, but one in which, according to various kinds of schemes, eventually the market would be completely removed and there would be some other kind of economic system that would be more akin with freedom. Sometimes it was spoken of as a kind of publicly controlled system of as much economic automation as possible, freeing individuals of the necessity of engaging in any kind of work, and involving a kind of distribution that might be thought of as to each according to need, under a system that sometimes was spoken of as communism, which had a very kind of meager institutional character because these same people tended to regard the state as an institution that had no ends of itself, of its own, that was not something that could be considered of intrinsic value. It was rather something purely instrumental. It served to allow a particular social interest, a particular economic class, to dominate all other groups. And in that way, it was an instrument of power that really had no reason for being once one eliminated class divisions and had this kind of emancipatory system, which was left with very little in the way of any kind of institutional fabric, because the state withered away. Economic relations seemed to be substituted by an automatic mechanism. And so Marx himself would sometimes speak of it as leaving us with a situation where individuals would choose to follow this or that path as they so desired, doing philosophy in the morning, painting in the afternoon, conversing in the evening, flitting from one thing to another. Sometimes people who are professing to subscribe to universal basic income regard it as having a similar kind of emancipation. Everyone gets a universal basic income. We are freed from having to work. And then what do? Well, we're sort of left with this hobby existence. Because after all, there we don't have the resources to engage in any kind of institutional activity. We are left with merely our purely private resources. And if it's a basic income, there's not much that we can do. Now, historically, there was this great divide in the movement that called itself socialist, and which arose in many respects as a reform movement, trying to protect society against what were regarded as the injustices of the emerging new form of industrial activity, of an emerging capitalist world. And at a certain point, there was a divide in the socialist movement, as we all know, between those who would follow the path to a so-called communist revolution, to which people like Lenin and Trotsky subscribed, and then those who wanted to take a different direction, who wanted, in a way, to make use of parliamentary democracy, to reform political institutions and the new emergent capitalist society from within, develop a strong labor movement, and push through the kind of reforms that would tame capitalism and allow it to be one in which economic opportunity could be more broadly enforced. And so you had these people who called themselves socialists as opposed to the communists. You had the Third International separating itself from the socialist movement and being led by the Russian revolutionaries under Lenin and Trotsky and later Stalin. And then you had the Second International, which remained a movement of various socialist groups. You had Edward Bernstein in Germany and in Austria-Hungary. You had Léon Blum in France under the United Front. You had all the socialist parties that were active in post-war Europe, Willy Brandt, Golda Meir, and others. And then you had socialists in a similar vein here in America under the likes of someone like Bernie Sanders or Ocasio-Cortez. And I think what is true of all of these people who would use the term socialists are two things. First of all, they're all capitalist roaders. They're all capitalist roaders in the sense that they all accept the existence of a society in which you have both a for-profit private sector in which enterprises sought to obtain profit and sustain themselves, and then you had a public sphere. And not only were all of these figures who branded themselves socialists, individuals who accepted the market as one that consisted of both a private and a public sector, they all were anything but revolutionaries. They all were reformers who wanted to make use of parliamentary systems to bring about the kind of reforms that would tame a capitalism that, if left to its own designs, fomented various kinds of injustice that put the family, society, and the state in jeopardy. Now, I think it's worthwhile to note that, because those who call themselves socialists in opposition to the communists of the Third International all, in effect, accept the existence of capitalism. And the acceptance of a market that has both a private and public sector is also uniformly accepted by all figures who might identify themselves as conservatives or being on the right. The most extreme such figures all acknowledge that we have to have a state. We need a state to uphold person and property. And the moment you have a state, you have individuals who are employed by the state. We have civil servants and the like, and we have a public sector. And a public sector that is part of a market that encompasses a private sector as well. And so really, if you want to think about the controversy between those more conservative political forces and those forces that sometimes are either branded with the word socialism or alternately, sometimes willingly accept that term, what really is at stake is not whether or not there is capitalism, whether or not we have a society in which there is both a for-profit private sector and a public sector, but how we regard these different sectors operating in connection with one another, and what kind of private and public interventions in the market are desirable.
One thing that I was sort of taught early on about a difference that might not be common knowledge, but mostly that Marx, Karl Marx himself, was a student of capitalism. And that sort of might be obvious, but it wasn't obvious to me that most of his books were sort of dedicated to try and get under the skin of capitalism to see how it functions and better understand it and progress from there. And so in some ways, to be Marxist, I mean, you have to have that mindset to know how that world functions. At least that's how I conceive of it.
Yeah. I mean, Marx had himself certain conflicting approaches in dealing with the phenomena he labeled capitalism. In that, on the one hand, he described it as an historically given form of economic relations that was not inherently just, and that he would claim was something that had tendencies within it that would bring about his own downfall. Now, he did not simply engage in trying to conceive its nature by developing the kind of model that one engages in when one is dealing with something one observes and knows about by means of observation. He instead, at least in his later works, the first part of which he himself published, Capital, Volume 1, the second and third volumes were put together by Engels and, in a sense, are both incomplete. But in these works, Marx sort of dealt with the relationships of the market economy and the role of capital within it by means of developing a kind of conceptual development where he began with the most elementary structures of market relationships and tried to follow out in terms of a conceptual development the internal constitution of this reality of market relations. And in doing so, he was really engaged in what could be considered a certain kind of thinking that was not really empirical in character, but might be thought of as being philosophical in character. Now, one thing that you see among philosophers, and I think this is an important point if we want to consider the nature of capital, is that philosophers by and large have recognized that one cannot simply use reason to conceive the nature of what conventions are. Because when we talk about conventions and institutions, they have something inherently arbitrary about them. They depend upon what choices individuals have made. And that means that there's no real necessity to what institutions exist or what will come to be or what have come to be. And for this reason, philosophers have not attempted to conceive using reason alone what the state is, what the family is, what society is. Now, they recognize that the institutions that have arisen in history have an inherently arbitrary character. But by contrast, what philosophy can do and what alone philosophy can do is think about what justice consists of, what institutions ought to be. And in this regard, they can think about what the state ought to be. What is a just state? What is a just society? What is a just household? And the philosophers worthy of the name have gone about trying to do that. And in doing so, they are not depending upon observation, because when you observe what institutions there are, that's not going to tell you what ought to be, because there's no guarantee that the institutions that exist are what they should be. You know, you can't simply take your guide about what justice is by taking a look at how institutions happen to be ordered. Now, I say all of this because on the one hand, Marx himself was thinking through the nature of capital, I think in a way that largely depended upon reason. And if that's the case, then he would have to admit that he was dealing with something that was an institution that is normative, that is what it ought to be, because that's what reason can capture. Not simply an historical formation that is arbitrary, but something that may have come to be, but had an intrinsic normative character. And he himself, you know, acknowledged that when you think about the prime relationship in a market society, that between employees and employer, there is something about it that involves a certain kind of justice, a certain kind of exercise of right. You know, in his early years, he spoke about the relation of the employee to the employer as if the employee was selling himself to the employer, as if in a way the employer took ownership. And that meant that the employee essentially had no property of any sort. He later revised this view and said that, well, what you engage in when you take up a job is you're not selling yourself in any respect. You're not a wage slave. You instead are offering, in exchange for a certain amount of money, the use of your ability to work for a limited amount of time. And what he had to acknowledge was that if you think about markets, they have a form of right in every kind of aspect of the market. I mean, the market is unlike other kinds of institutions where, for example, people perform certain kind of activities. They give you certain things and do so in a way, according to tradition or according to some kind of unilateral offering. Likewise, you will simply provide people with certain services or give them something because that is the way it is. But in a market, no one is bound to offer up any particular item or to provide any determinate service. You're rather in a situation where whatever you're going to provide for others is something you're only going to provide through a transaction in which there is a kind of reciprocity, where they're going to obtain what you have to offer only under the condition that they have what you need and you are willing to accept it in return from what you are offering to them. That's the nature, of course, of any kind of commodity exchange. It's something that is mutual, and each party decides what it is they're going to offer up and what it is they're going to accept in return. Now, when that becomes a situation in which we engage in all of our activities of production and consumption, that's happening in a situation where we don't have the opportunity to simply obtain everything we need from nature without having to interact with others. It's also something that occurs only when we're in a situation where we can't obtain from others what we need, nor are we required to give to others what they may desire, except by entering into voluntary agreements. So there's a certain kind of rightful freedom at work in every kind of market relation. And in that sense, it could be regarded as being an institution of freedom that involves a liberation from all of those traditional bonds where what occupation you fulfill, what goods you have, or what you provide to others are dictated independently of your choice. The market subverts all such relationships. And in that regard, it is something that has a kind of validity as an institution of freedom. Now, many people want to say that, well, a market is something that is inherently efficient, as if that were the justification for having markets take care of a particular sphere of activity. But look, I think we all know that markets are far from efficient. Anytime there's a recession or a depression, it becomes quite blatantly obvious that there is a tremendous inefficiency plaguing markets. After all, there's tremendous overproduction, unused capacity. And one of the most depressing unused capacities is unemployment, where people simply can't find work. And I think what this indicates is, if we're going to think about markets, we recognize that they are institutions of freedom. But we need to think about how the kind of freedom that requires markets for its exercise is something that is not going to be available to everyone unless the market is subject to certain kinds of interventions, both public and private. And that is something that we need to explore.
Right. So that's, I guess, the question of where the state comes in. I mean, the market might have potential. I guess I'm having trouble because the market might have potential for these interactions that actualize certain freedom, but it also grabs the potential user and draws them in, and sometimes in very problematic ways that Marx laid out. And so there, I guess, lies some sort of need for intervention to try and correct the market. And
I think it's good to first try to focus on what happens if we let the market operate under conditions where there is a state. After all markets operate insofar as the participants in the market respect the property of others. You know, I'm not unilaterally stealing what others have when I engage in a market exchange. I'm respecting that they have ownership over the commodities they're bringing to market, just as they're accepting and recognizing my ownership of what I'm offering in the marketplace. Otherwise, they would just take it, you know, unilaterally. And of course, if property relations are to be upheld, then you need a system of law and order, and ultimately you need a body politic. And there are conservatives who want to say that, well, freedom is really restricted to a matter of upholding person and property and letting markets operate, and we should have a state that does nothing more than simply protect the property relations that are working the market and let the market go its merry way. And I think to understand what that means, we have to make a few very basic moves in thinking about how markets operate. You know, the initial situation, which many economic theorists begin with, is the idea, the elementary market situation, where you enter the market because you have something that you can offer up to others, but you want something that they have to offer in exchange. And that means that fundamental market situation is where we have commodity owners confronting one another, and they have to have, of course, a different commodity ownership. I have to have something that the other party lacks, just as they have to have something that I lack. And what I'm going to offer them is something that I don't need, that I can relinquish. And that's sort of the basic situation. Now, of course, if we think of that kind of relationship, we're thinking about a barter relationship, right? Where I have some good, and I'm only going to be able to satisfy needs of my choosing if I can find someone who has what I need, and then also that they want what I have in exchange. Now, of course, that indicates the limitation of barter as a way of facilitating the kind of situation where we are able to exercise our choice of obtaining from others what we have chosen to obtain from them in return for what we are willing to offer up and what they have chosen to take in return. What facilitates our general economic freedom of being able to obtain what we would like and being able to offer up to others something that they will willingly take in return is when a particular commodity becomes recognized by others as a means of exchange for all other commodities. In other words, I'm talking about the commodity money. And when you have money, then other commodities can have a price. And that means that if you have a certain amount of money, you can obtain any commodity that has a price not above how much money you have. And you don't have to worry about the person who is selling that commodity having to want the specific commodities you have. You know, money, in other words, facilitates all of that. And it's a natural development in market relations that you move from barter to a money commodity and monetary exchange or exchange of commodities mediated through money, which operates as a means of circulation of commodities. But then the moment you have money, it's possible to engage in a very different kind of economic relationship. That is, instead of bringing some commodity to market in order to obtain some other market, other commodity exchange, you can now advance money in the marketplace in order to obtain more money in return. And that means you can engage in a kind of economic relationship which has as its aim nothing other than the accumulation of wealth. And all you need for that to happen is for there to be a market in which individuals have different commodities and in which they are all willing to recognize a particular commodity as serving as money. Now that then changes the nature of the economy because it means that you have individuals who can be engaging in purchasing other commodities in order to be able to sell them at a profit. And that then sets up a situation where the market becomes infused with the plurality of, you could say, entrepreneurs, individuals who are advancing money for the sake of obtaining more in return. And the thing is that they then find themselves in a situation of competition where they have to ensure that they are able to obtain their revenues against others, entrepreneurs who may be offering similar commodities to the market. And in order to survive, these entrepreneurs are going to have to grow and expand in order to be able to have the resources to produce more efficiently, produce new products, engage in a kind of marketing activities. And that means we now have a kind of polarization in the market where these expanding enterprises need to put people to work to carry out their expanded operations. And that means we have a market where you have this polarity developing through nothing other than the dynamic of market relations themselves, where you have far fewer employers than employees. And the employers are enterprises that need to grow and expand in order to remain competitive. Now, here we have a dynamic of competition that arises through the market situation, the emergence of money, and then the emergence of profit-seeking enterprise. Well, that creates a situation where you have, on the one hand, a certain inequality of opportunity that is sort of systemic to the workings of the market. And that's, first of all, the inequality in opportunity between employer and employee. Even though the transaction in question involves mutuality, in other words, no employee is forced to work for an employer. They work by engaging in an agreement to accept a certain amount of wage or salary in exchange for working for a determined amount of time. Right? They're not unilaterally taken up. But you have to think about what are the options that employers have on the one hand and employees have on the other. You know, the mere fact that employers are far fewer in number and have, in a way, a larger amount of wealth under their disposal, allowing them to employ a plurality of employees, that signifies, in a way, that the options of employers are far greater than those of employees. In other words, employers can select among a far greater number of employees in general than employees can select employers. There's an imbalance. And then you have a situation where, you know, enterprises, however they be organized, have to, in a sense, grow their profits so that they can reinvest and make themselves more competitive. And that means that the processes of competition are going to lead enterprises to face a necessity of having to be as mean and lean as possible. Now, that does not mean that an entrepreneur is necessarily a scoundrel, right? An entrepreneur might want to, for example, not employ child labor. An entrepreneur might not want to employ workers for more than 8 hours a day. An entrepreneur might want to have safe working conditions. An entrepreneur might want to produce products that are safe and healthy, that don't have any kind of built-in obsolescence in them. An employer might want to take precautions so that they don't despoil the environment. But if any of these measures require added costs that meaner and leaner competitors can avoid, a well-meaning entrepreneur finds that they will be driven out of business. And competition, in other words, is going to pressure them to do things that, in a way, put in jeopardy the welfare of families, put in jeopardy the welfare of society, and also put in jeopardy the welfare of politics for the following reason. If we have a political system such as ours, which allows private enterprises to use their wealth to influence public policy, to fund the campaigns of the candidates they favor, or to fund also advertising campaigns to influence public opinion in ways that will serve their economic interests, this is something that itself becomes part of the competitive pressure. In other words, if you have enterprises that refrain from using their wealth to tip the political atmosphere in a way that serves them at the expense of others, if they refrain from doing that, they're going to be undercut by those firms that take that advantage. So in a sense, there's an economic drive for enterprises to throw their weight into the political domain if that allows them an opportunity to serve their own economic interests. And I think you can see that all of this indicates that if we let the market simply operate on its own, it can lead to a situation where the welfare of families is jeopardized by, for example, firms not providing any kind of balance between work and family in terms of providing paid leave, restricting working hours, having flexible schedules, avoiding child labor and the like. Equally, we can see how firms, just driven by the need to stay in business, will do things that can go against some of the preconditions of social welfare, despoiling the environment, producing goods that are not safe, producing working conditions that are unhealthy and the like, and then also infecting the political domain by taking advantage of what opportunities there may be to use their economic clout to gain disproportionate influence in the political sphere, even under conditions of universal suffrage, and use that to benefit themselves at the expense of their competitors and others in society.
Today, this problem surely seems to be exacerbated, where the level of information gathered is, and the newest technology is becoming that of the human subject. I mean, the online profile and the person interacting with that are now becoming products within these competitive markets, and it's further complicating maybe the relationship not just between an employer and employee, but a potential internet user and the opinion that's given to them.
Remember, now we have this explosion of businesses, internet businesses, Google, Facebook, and the like, where it's really information about the users that is what is of value to them. And they really serve as, at the same time, as gatekeepers to what information we have available to us, which obviously has tremendous influence on politics and in many respects can undercut any genuine kind of political freedom. Now, by the way, in all of these domains, you can see that entrepreneurs, you know, do not personally have to be scoundrels, do not have to themselves be driven by no other concern than increasing their profits. But the point is, if they try to resist those measures that, in a sense, pad their bottom line, they are going to be less competitive. And they're going to tend to be driven out of business. In a way, if we want to talk about saving the souls of entrepreneurs, the only way to do that is for we citizens to put general rules and regulations on business that require them to do the right thing. Because if that's the case, if we require them to pay decent wages, have decent flexible hours, create safe products, respect the environment, refrain from pushing their weight around in the political sphere, we allow them to, in a sense, act in an ethical manner and remain competitive. Because these restraints are applied to all enterprises. And that means no one is at a competitive disadvantage by subscribing to them. This is why, in a way, if you want to talk about the essence of business ethics, and I don't think they teach this at the Terry School of Business here at UGA, it's that what allows entrepreneurs and businesses to be ethical is that they're subject to public regulation that ensures that they're not allowed to compete unless they act in a way that is in accord with our different types of ethical communities, the family as it should be, a free society, and a self-governing politics.
I think it's really important that you remind us that it's really up to the citizens to demand this of a state. And oftentimes, I mean, I'm not against recycling, but there seems to be a sort of culture around blaming the citizen for these big problems and externalities coming from corporations. And in fact, I mean, it should be sort of turned on the head and turned on its head in that respect.
I mean, it's one thing that I think has infected a lot of discussion about how we really want to make capitalism have a human face, have it be something that can be compatible with equal opportunity to exercise the freedoms that, at least with regard to economic freedom, we need markets. You know, if we're going to be able to exercise a freedom of occupation, a freedom of need, where we're in a position to decide on our own what it is we want to obtain, what it is, what kind of work we want to do, and so forth. We need markets. But some people want to say that what allows capitalism to be in accord with justice is how enterprises themselves are organized, what forms of ownership apply. And I think one has to keep in mind that an enterprise, and another way of speaking about it, is a unit of capital, can be owned in all sorts of different ways. You know, you can have an individual owner who owns the capital, who may or may not be involved in the management of the firm. You can have a family that owns it. It's possible for the employees to own the firm. And here you have a kind of a worker cooperative. A firm, an enterprise, can also be owned by a public institution. I mean, after all, I teach at the University of Georgia. It is a kind of enterprise. It is a public institution. It is owned, what could say, by the state of Georgia. There are municipalities that own various things, such as their water system, or they can have utilities, etc. Or they have, of course, their own workforce. You can have state enterprises in terms of the states in our republic, or you can have federal enterprises as well. And, you know, there were certain socialists who wanted to claim that if we had public ownership, that would guarantee that the tendencies of the market would be, in a way, made more human, made automatically serving the needs of people. Now, I think the experience of those nations, some of which have called themselves capitalist, communist, I should say, you know, have reduced as much as possible private ownership of enterprises and have had a kind of state monopoly where, in effect, everyone is an employee of the state with very, very limited independent for-profit enterprises. I think we've seen historically that there's no guarantee that that ensures that the enterprises themselves respect the environment, that they provide decent working hours and decent conditions of work that are safe, that they produce products that are safe. In a certain degree, it presents a form of enterprise that has the greatest degree of monopoly. And that can also involve a lack of accountability, especially if we're concerned with this. We're speaking about a state that has a one-party political system and a party that itself is dominated by a leader who, in effect, persecutes his opposition. So I think one can see, in a certain sense, there's no automatic guarantee that public ownership is automatically going to serve the public interest. Also, when you think about worker self-managed enterprises or worker cooperatives, there's some who want to say that, well, look, that is going to serve the interests of the employees. After all, they are going to be in command. But one thing you have to recognize is that when we're talking about an enterprise, it is one of many in a market. And what may benefit an enterprise and its employees may be to the disadvantage of other competitors in the marketplace. So in a way, there's no guarantee that what happens within an enterprise, owing to its specific form of organization ownership, is necessarily going to be something that will promote the rights of others outside that enterprise. Each of these units, even state-owned enterprises, are going to still be confronting the same dynamic of competition with all of the pressures that that involves. Now, one thing, by the way, regarding the idea of workers' cooperative, you know, which there's nothing inherently wrong with it. In the United States, there are 300 worker cooperatives, that is, firms that are owned and administered by their employees. They have a total number of employees of 7,000. You know, we have some in Athens. The Economic Justice Coalition in Athens is promoting the idea of worker cooperatives, and there are a couple of small worker cooperatives that they have helped set up. But, you know, there's a certain inherent weakness to a worker cooperative in terms of the process of competition, which I think is reflected in how few there are and how few employees they have. And that is, to be competitive, a firm has to obtain as much capital as it can. And I think it's precisely for this reason that the dominant form of organization of an enterprise is that of a public share issuing corporation. Because a public share issuing corporation is able to obtain capital from anyone who buys its stock, who could be anywhere in the world. And they obtain this capital without having to pay any charges for borrowing, for example. And it allows them to amass sufficient funds to upgrade their manufacturing, their marketing, et cetera, develop new products, do R&D research. And it's really for this reason why that tends to be the dominant form of enterprise in all modern market societies. And I think it's important to recognize that because it tells us something about what kind of regulations are going to be ones that promote the common good, protect our families, protect equal economic opportunity in society, and protect our body politic from domination of corporate influence.
Well, our economy is certainly one that, at least when you're talking about the efficiency of a workers' cooperative, our economy is one that benefits off of speed and timeliness. And I mean, this is what's sort of talked about, I guess, when efficiency is mentioned. But this is also maybe potentially, I mean, some of the problems people get caught up in the gears when they're moving too quickly. Mm. And the problem with the worker co-op there is the ability to make a proper decision on time and being able to adapt to this kind of level of competition. And I guess this is where, you know.
Well I want to say rather the real problem with worker cooperatives is that they're not able to amass the amount of capital that a public share issuing corporation can. Because the moment you issue shares, you're dispersing the ownership of the company. Whereas a workers' cooperative wants to retain ownership in the hands of the workers. Mm-hmm. Now there's another approach to, in a way, upholding the interests of employees, even when we're dealing with this dominant form of business, namely a public share-issuing corporation. And that is one of the ways of not using public regulation from outside, but a kind of private intervention. One of those private interventions, which of course has been alive and well as a form of self-protection of employees, and that's union organization. And of course, union organization can be made more difficult or easier depending upon what kind of laws a state issues to enable employees to safely organize and engage in collective bargaining. But that is a way of evening the playing field and overcoming the inherent imbalance between employer on the one hand and employee on the other. But there's a second way of doing it with regard to the structure of corporations, of public corporations. And that is this idea of employee co-determination, where you reserve at least 50% of corporate seats for employees elected by their peers. In that way, the governance of the corporation is no longer completely out of the hands of employees. Instead, they have a fair say. And that has, I think, massive implications. You know, we know in the United States, we have a tyranny of corporate governance, where employees, by and large, have absolutely no say. Communities have no say. Rather, it's simply shareholders, and often it's the founders of the company who have special reserve shares that allow them to remain dominant, and they're in cahoots with the CEO. So the CEO will end up making in the United States 300 times what other employees do, which is not good for business, but it's great for the CEO and the board of directors, who are also paid hand over fist for whatever work they do. And of course, they make all the decisions concerning transferring production abroad, selling off parts of the company to increase the stock value of shareholders. That would change if we had worker co-determination. That's another one of the major ways in which we can have a private intervention on enterprises to make them more ethical. And at the same time, we as citizens can have the proper kind of regulations.
And these board of directors and, you know, future CEOs and whatnot typically are sort of fast-tracked business or engineering students who typically don't go through maybe the similar kind of comeuppance that somebody would, anybody else in the company would. I mean, normally they're isolated and put on sort of a pedestal to become the next of the elite, and so that it retains the fences around the house that would be the head of the company.
I mean, there's one other thing that I want to bring up in terms of these ideas of worker cooperatives and also of worker co-determination, where we transform corporations from within to ensure that employees have a fair say in employee governance. And there's some people who want to say that this is a matter of democratizing the economy and that it's really part of what it means for a democracy to be participatory. That is, we democratize social institutions. We could democratize the university. I mean, for example, if you apply the principle of employee co-determination to my workplace, it would mean that the Board of Regents would no longer be full of business people and political cronies of the governor and the like. Instead, at least half the seats on the Board of Regents would be held by employees, including faculty and staff. And certainly that would change the approach our university system would be taking right now to how to operate during the coronavirus pandemic. But I think it's a mistake to think that this is what it means to extend democracy. Because when you're dealing with allowing employees to have a say, a fair say, in the governance of an enterprise, be it public or private, what one's concerned with is, in a sense, the particular interest of that enterprise and the interest of the people who are part of it. That's different from the common good. And proper politics is always about the common good. It's always about how we are to govern the entire body politic for the sake of upholding the rights and freedoms of everyone. And I think, you know, there's this slogan that I think is correct. You know, It used to be said that what is good for General Motors is what is good for America. Well, that's not true. What is good for an enterprise is not what is good for America. We don't want business leaders as our statesmen, because business is concerned with making a profit and fattening the wealth of stockholders and the like. And the same thing actually applies to employees. I mean, they are concerned with their own economic welfare. And that's not necessarily the same as the welfare of workers in other enterprises or other sectors of the population or other interests. And for that reason, what is good for America is not neither what is good for General Motors nor what is good for the United Auto Workers. We do want all of these particular interests to be fairly balanced. But when we're dealing with politics, here we're concerned with the common good, with the universal. We want all interests to be fairly handled. But we also want to deal with ensuring that everyone's rights are upheld and that we're leading the nation in a way that it will be for the common good. And that means in our role as citizens, we are presiding over the economy for the sake of ensuring that it allows everyone to have equal economic opportunity, equal social opportunity, that we're able to balance work and family so that our family welfare and our freedoms in the family are upheld. But also we want to ensure that our government, our democracy, is not overwhelmed by particular interests in society, particularly particular wealthy interests that use their accumulation of wealth to disproportionately influence political agendas. No, we want to secure our freedoms at every level. And doing that, that is a matter of making capitalism have a human face, where we allow the market to operate as an institution of freedom, but subject to both private and public interventions that ensure that our freedoms are at every level protected, that we have equal opportunity in every sphere. And for that reason, when one thinks about capitalism, you have to recognize there is a form of capitalism which is not properly subject to regulations. When capitalism is not properly regulated, it becomes a recipe for oligarchy, a recipe for powerful economic interests subverting equal political opportunity. And that's what happens when you have a minimal state, a state that only concerns itself with protecting person and property and letting the market operate without any restrictions. Unfortunately, you know, we have a whole political party, the Republican Party, which now is moving in that direction of restricting the public regulations that protect the common good against the ravages of unbridled pursuit of profit and wealth. And we have to stand up and ensure that what's left of our democracy does not succumb to the force of oligarchy, which is what an unbridled market, a capitalism without a human face, a capitalism that has no public restraints, inevitably draws us into. And now, of course, we have to keep in mind one other thing, and that is the climate emergency we're facing. Because, as we well know, there are all sorts of industries. In fact, the most wealthy industry in human history, the fossil fuel industry, would just as soon continue making its huge profits and not have to forsake all the investments it's made in its fossil fuel extraction, exploration, and processing industries, and wants to put off as much as possible any shift to green energy, and is using its wealth to propagandize against the scientific consensus that is telling us we need to act immediately. Well, if we let the market operate without restraint, we're not only subverting our freedoms for ourselves, but we are going to drive the planet to a situation where it will be more and more inhospitable for future generations. So for this reason, the quest to make capitalism take on a human face is a matter of human survival. And it's something that we need to take into account as we face this most fateful of elections on November 3rd.